please! Avenge me! Avenge me!
Another episode of BC and Maurice's Constant Content Crisis, watching the scum of the universe so you don't have to. I'm your host, Dr. Maurice Welp, and I'm joined by my dashing co-host, BC Noir. What have you been up to, BC?
I actually went to the theater recently, saw Dune 2 this weekend, which was amazing. I got an opportunity to watch some snippets of Expats, which I think I'll continue watching. And I'm jonesing to see the new X-Men series. In the meantime, I'm going to catch up with the old one before it starts, but that's something I'm looking forward to. How about yourself?
Yeah, it's been busy. I haven't watched maybe as much as I would like to outside of the things that we are going to talk about today. I randomly decided to watch Uncle Buck with my children the other day. I was about to stick on The Breakfast Club, and then I swerved it at the last minute because I thought it might be a bit too, not grown up, but kind of a bit too teenage for my young sons. And we ended up with Uncle Buck, and they really enjoyed the giant pancakes and just John Candy's general vibe. It was quite fun. Within about, I'd say about 20 seconds of John Candy's character being on screen, both my sons just turned to me and said, "Oh, I like him." And I was like, yeah, I think that's the desired effect for John Candy in a John Hughes movie. And then my partner sort of turned to me and she was like, didn't he pass away? And I was like, yeah, not long after this. But he was jolly while he was here. So, yeah, but the rest of the stuff, I mean, I've been watching The Bad Batch. I'm sure you have too, but that's for a future episode. So
yeah, that's good stuff.
It is good stuff. And, you know, let's just get on our mini soapbox and say, if you've not delved into the Star Wars animated universe, do yourself a favor. There's hours of content there, and much of it a lot better than anything we've seen on the big screen for many years.
Yeah, I concur.
Okay. Anyway, we're meant to be saving you time, not filling your time. So as ever, we are going to talk about some things that we've been watching over the last few weeks, some of it on the television, well, probably all of it on the television, but some of it for the television, some of it for the big screen. So as ever, I'm going to throw the curveball over to my colleague, BC. What have you got for us?
This year's Oscars 2024. I had the opportunity to watch the Academy Awards, and I would say it was pretty good, much better than I imagined. There were a bit hiccups from my perspective, but there were no major surprises. I think, you know, there was definitely some upsets, but all the winners made perfect sense to me, especially if you've been tracking award season. I think Emma Stone's win was, quite an upset. But if you've seen Poor Things, it makes total sense. The projected winner was Lily Gladstone, but I just don't think anyone could have surpassed Emma Stone's performance in Poor Things in that category for best actress.
I think fair enough. I mean, Lily Gladstone was great, but it's a much smaller performance for starters, through no fault of her own. But I feel like it teeters on the brink of supporting actress for me. I don't know. But yeah, I don't think the two can really be fairly compared. I think it's they're just such different kind of performances. And Emma Stone really, really deserved it this year.
And I think, you know, early on, people thought that the star of The Holdovers,
Steven Seagal,
Chuck Norris. Oh man,
Paul Giamatti.
Yeah, I need a different list. I got just the winners. I got the winners on my list, not like the nominees. So I'm like, oh, this doesn't work. But yeah, like people thought that, yeah, again, Paul Giamatti was going to be a shoe-in. However, I think looking at the BAFTAs and how Oppenheimer really took all the awards, I think the writing was on the wall for what was going to happen at the Oscars. It's the same you could see with like Saltburn getting some nods at the Golden Globes or and even Barbie. But then just when the Oscars came around, either, you know, some would say like Barbie was snubbed or Margot Robbie was snubbed. But ultimately, the Academy picked the best, who they thought was the best or which films they thought were the best. So I thought the winners, you know, were chosen accurately given the stiff competition.
Yeah, it's such a strange concept to me anyway, because ultimately it's someone's opinion. It doesn't mean that you empirically made the best film of the year. And something you'll see a lot around this time is, you know, lists of the worst Oscar winners ever or the worst best actors ever. And, you know, that just goes to show that, like, with a bit of hindsight, sometimes I don't want to say the Academy didn't make the right decision, because I don't think there is a right decision. You're dealing with a subjective thing. So, you know, ultimately, I guess the films that win maybe get a little boost. They get a bit of a jump in their chances at surviving in the years to come. But I think a film like Barbie, it doesn't really need to win an Oscar. You know, I think it had its moment in the sun. Everyone was talking about that movie all year. It's probably going to be remembered for longer than many of the films that it was competing with. So this kind of idea of snubs, I don't know. I don't really get involved in it.
Some people were disappointed that Japan didn't push Godzilla Minus One forward for best foreign film. I think was it possibly Anatomy of Fall or Zone of Interest was another one that wasn't also put in that category. As projected, you know, got Christopher Nolan winning for Best Director, which is no brainer, and that was his first Academy Award for director. We have, you know, Cillian Murphy as well, that was also highly celebrated, and again, it makes perfect sense. Also, you know, I was really disappointed with Into the Spider-Verse not winning, but again, you can't, you know, compete with Miyazaki. So, And then in terms of the actual ceremony itself, I thought it was a lot of fun. I thought, again, Jimmy Kimmel did, you know, his best with what he had, and he didn't disappoint. And I just think the biggest, like, drawback was just the in memoriam sequence, where again there were dancers and singers, and you couldn't see actually all the great talent who passed away this year, and or at the end just their names were like scattershot across the screen and you couldn't see them. So you couldn't see who passed, and they weren't, in my eyes, like properly respected during the ceremony. But for me, the rest of it, you know, I think was funny. There were some great bits. And I think the inclusion of having like former winners actually, you know, come up and say, acknowledge the different nominees. In some ways, I thought it was really interesting and touching. It looked like a lot of the praise was written by, you know, the writers for the ceremony. And these actors are just reading from a teleprompter. So
yeah,
I thought it would be better if you had, you know, something more heartfelt, or maybe friends of the nominees come up and actually say something, you know, passionate about the nominees. At times you could see the actors on stage who were close to the nominees actually look and speak at the nominees in the audience. And other times you're just reading off the teleprompter, and you would have, you know, in the same split screen, you would have the nominee just sitting there smiling or nodding, just listening. And, you know, it's all kind of for show, literally.
Yeah.
So I thought that was a bit strange.
Yeah, I mean, I think I watched Danny DeVito and Arnold Schwarzenegger doing their bit with Michael Keaton. that was all great. I watched of the Oscars. But I enjoyed that a lot. It's right up there with Ed 209 and Pee Wee Herman for classic Oscar bits.
No, but I think like the John Cena, you know, streaker bit was funny. Also Kate McKinnon, you know, thinking that Jurassic Park was, you know, a documentary and, you know, Spielberg was in on the joke. And no, I think a lot of those skits are usually, or bits are usually painful. And I thought this year they were actually like clever and funny. And also you could see the advertising in it where you had the different pairs, you know, like you had Ryan Gosling and Emma, I was going to call her Krasinski, Emma, John Krasinski's Emily Blunt? Wife.
Emily Blunt.
Oh, not Emma, sorry. Emily Blunt. They were together, you know, having a bit about Barbie and, you know, Oppenheimer, but also they're going to be in The Fall Guy.
Which I'm looking forward to, yeah.
Are you serious?
Yeah. I think it's going to be great.
Okay.
I've got high hopes. I don't know. I love a good action movie, and it feels like it's going to be very, like, reverent and loving. And, like, I think the guy did Bullet Train, but he also did Deadpool, right? The guy that's directing it. I don't know. Something like that. But he's done... I didn't watch Bullet Train, but the other movie he'd done was, like, an enjoyable action romp that didn't take itself too seriously. And I just think Ryan Gosling has got the ability to kind of elevate material like this. Emily Blunt's very good. It's almost too obvious that a remake of the Fall Guy is going to be terrible, that I just don't feel like Ryan Gosling would sign up to it unless it was something that's going to be just kind of a throwback and very entertaining. But, you know, who knows, maybe I'll be wrong, but he's a funny guy, and I think he's got a good nose for this kind of script.
Yeah, you're right. So it's David Leitch. But yeah, like if you mentioned Bullet Train, it makes me think of Chad Stahelski, and he's directed the John Wick movies, and then he has his own production company or studio. I'm not sure what it's called, but basically, you know, it's a wheelhouse for like stuntmen. So, and some of the directors in his stable are former stuntmen. So yeah, this is the guy who directed Bullet Train, I think he was also Brad Pitt's stunt double, because Brad Pitt's in Bullet Train as well. So yeah, so action wise, I'm sure it'll be amazing. If there's going to be anything else to, like, you know, as a draw for me, I'm not sure. Just with the commercial I saw, I was just like, okay, it looks like, you know, the typical comedy blockbuster. But if there's more to it, that'll be a good thing.
Sorry to divert from the Oscars.
No, but there's also some great speeches as well. So, I mean, I really like Cord Jefferson's speech about, you know, just making, you know, taking those blockbuster dollars and feeding into making more like independent, smaller films. That was great.
And then he ripped me off, though. I've been saying that for years. Literally the whole take $100 million and make, you know, $25 million films. I mean, it's not a revolutionary thought. I'm not suggesting that he really ripped me off, but he's absolutely right.
Yeah, but I mean, he's also someone who kind of came out of nowhere. I think he directed small things, but I think this was also, you know, I think this was the first movie he directed, right?
Yeah,
he won for a best adapted screenplay, but I think he might have done some things here and there for like television. But, you know, American Fiction is something that's definitely on my list. Wes Anderson also got his first Oscar.
What did he get an Oscar for?
He did a short film that aired on or streamed on Netflix.
That's interesting, though. But also, well, he directed a feature film this year, and I wonder how you feel as a director to almost be, you know, I don't want to say competing against yourself, but I feel like Wes Anderson is someone who makes a film and fancies himself to be in the running for, you know, screenplay or cinematography or something. I mean, obviously he wouldn't get the credit for cinematography, but you know what I mean. So it's interesting. Does it feel like a kind of step down to win a short film Oscar when you're like a noted successful Hollywood director? I don't know. Like, it's,
well, I think he was projected to win and then he didn't show up. So I don't know what that means.
Yeah. I just feel like short films are the province of the rising director. So, you know, it's like a professional athlete going to play in a kid's game and sort of being surprised when they win the trophy. Like, I don't know, but that's probably hugely insulting to people that make short films exclusively. So, sorry.
No, I don't really know the story behind, what is it called? It is called...
It's a Roald Dahl story, isn't it? Henry Sugar it? Or something?
Oh, oh, the Wonderful Story of Henry Sugar. I don't... Mm. Yeah, I'm not, you know, I'm not familiar with everything in Dahl's library, but I didn't see
what's
the short.
Left of it. Yeah.
And also, it's also... It starred with Cumberbatch, right?
Cumberbatch, Ben Kingsley, I think Dev Patel... various other people that suit Wes Anderson's kind of deadpan dialogue and stilted delivery. Like, it's I do want to watch it. It does look fun, but yeah, I have an interesting relationship with Wes Anderson. I've sort of fallen out of love with him, as it were, or his work. I mean, we were never in love, but
yeah, I mean, it was the same. I love Bottle Rockets. And then Rushmore, definitely. And then after that, it was Diminishing Returns. I think you know, Life Aquatic, I remember laughing and howling at. But then, like, yeah, Royal Tenenbaums, I vaguely remember. I saw that in the theaters. Never went back to it. And then, oh, I do like, you know, Fantastic Mr. Fox. That was great.
Yeah, that's great. That's great.
I mean, maybe to me, it's probably his best one for me. And then there's another one. What's the other animated one he did? The one set in Japan, The Isle of Dogs. And that was okay. Awesome. Yeah, it was okay. But yeah, I agree. Yeah. I haven't seen much. I don't think I've seen any of his movies after Isle of Dogs. You see the trailer and you're like, oh, I've seen the movie.
Yeah, Grand Budapest Hotel was pretty good, actually. That was a bit of a comeback, but he's just... I mean, you know, I've no issue. He's just kind of, he crafted a style and he doesn't ever really stray from it. And he's very good at approximating a sort of idea of emotion and depth and philosophy. But when I really scratch the surface, there's not much underneath it. So it's all a bit fleeting, you know, and the film that he made this year was very much like that. It had some nice moments that were kind of intricately set up, Asteroid City I'm talking about, and you know, it was fine, but you know, it I think it purported to be a lot more profound than it was. It was really kind of just saying life's like a play where you don't know the lines but just improvise, and it's like, oh, that's nice, that's cute. Like, okay. That's fine, thanks Wes, you know, I'll have a nice time, good luck at the short film Oscar. I don't know.
Let's see. So I mentioned Murphy. I think he was the first Irish-born actor to win an Oscar. Maybe
wow,
for that
really?
Category. Yeah.
I'm thinking, who's that old Irish actor? That I'm trying to think. Not Peter O'Toole. Richard Harris. Maybe these are guys that are like Irish by blood and they were actually born in England. I feel like Richard Harris was Irish and surely won an Oscar, but I'm not going to...
Well, I think it's for best actor, first Irish born.
Okay. Right.
For best actor.
I'm certainly not going to fact check it.
And then, yeah, I loved what it was I made for, you know, sung by Billie Eilish. Who else? We'll talk about Emma Stone in a minute. We have The Zone of Interest, best international feature film. Divine, Joy Randolph. I think she had a clean sweep through, like, you know, all the awards. And I think just watching her in every speech she's given was amazing. And again, I think just her performance, you know, was great in the holdovers. even though now I guess there's some controversy about it possibly being like ripped off.
Plagiarized.
I mean, there's one thing, you know, that's come up recently, like, you know, as I try to write, and more I hear that people in industries will say, don't send me your scripts. I don't want to read them. I don't want any ideas in my head. I don't want to get caught up in anything. Don't send them to me. Don't send them to me. And I guess he read this guy's script. So or what have you. So that's interesting. But it looks like it didn't affect too much in terms of the awards, at least for Randolph. Robert Downey Jr. was another person that everyone expected to win. Coranson is, you know, also second Oscar for creating a score for a movie. So I think the first one was Black Panther and now Oppenheimer. And then the team that gave the speech for 20 Days in Mariupol was amazing. Just talking about the death and destruction that happened in Ukraine and just kind of how this was a lukewarm win where they wish they didn't have to make a movie about their country being like, you know, bombed to oblivion. And that was a real powerful sentiment. So if you have an opportunity to watch the Oscars, it's still on Hulu. I'm sure you can see many a clip on YouTube. If you have about 3 hours to spare, I don't know who does. I think it's worth watching. And if, at least, if anything else, like just go and watch those movies. I think every movie that was nominated or won is worth watching. I think between me and you, we've seen quite a few now.
Absolutely, yeah. That's probably my favorite part of the whole, not even just the Oscars, but awards season in general, is it is a good film list. And I feel like maybe there was a time when it wasn't so great, but I think we're past couple of years, we're very much back on track now. The films that are cropping up at the Oscars are good movies generally, so that's helpful. But yeah, I'm not a fan of the pageantry or the kind of the bonhomie between like actors and people in the industry. Like, I don't hate it, but I think just by my nature, I'm quite anti-establishment. So it's good. It's a good thing to aspire for. I think maybe it does feel sometimes like there are people who are just eventually going to win an award, and it feels more like the stars lining up for like someone like Chris Nolan. It's like, well, I haven't seen Oppenheimer yet, but I'd be willing to bet that it's not his best film. So it almost feels like, you know, I think what did Scorsese win one for The Departed? It's like, I wouldn't even put that probably in his top five, you know. So it is what it is. And it does put eyes on cinema. And that is important. That's a thing that we love. And if the Oscars helps more films get made and more films that are interesting and thought-provoking, then I'm happy to let it continue existing. I'll try not to be too much like George C. Scott or Marlon Brando. Although I did read about Marlon Brando sending, I should have written down the name of the actress because that would be the respectful thing to do, but just in terms of how times have changed, not only did Clint Eastwood make a kind of joke in a speech he gave later on in the evening, you know, because I think she basically, her speech was, you know, refusing the concept of Hollywood and the Oscar because of the portrayal of Native Americans and the treatment of Native Americans by Hollywood over the years. Clint Eastwood came up and said something to the effect of, you know, maybe I should apologize for all the bad guys that were shot in John Ford movies. And apparently John Wayne had to be held back by six bouncers on the side of the stage from, you know, physically accosting the Native American actress that Marlon Brando sent up to accept his award for The Godfather. So, you know, we're in a different world now. I mean, if that had happened, then Will Smith probably would have got no play at all for his actions. But just to think, this kind of hoary old 60-year-old cowboy, like trying to storm the stage to beat up a young woman. Times have changed. Thank God.
Yeah, I mean, I guess, and that's what you see as well with the Golden Globes. You see this in terms of, again, you know, the diversity and in the nominees and the winners. Like more and more, you see that, you know, America being reflected on the stage. I mean, on, you know, Lily Gladstone didn't get her moment. I mean, but she's definitely recognized. And I think, you know, Killers of the Flower Moon being claimed and putting all that history out there, you know, even though I think people in the school districts in Osage are still fighting, you know, against really promoting that history, which is, you know, absolutely shocking and believable. But you can see that still with art and cinema, there's still places where, you know, this history can be told and recognized. You know, maybe not everyone will agree, but at least there's freedom of speech and, you know, and opportunities for people to have their stories told. Again, looking at like Zone of Interest, Poor Things, you know, I just mentioned the 20 Days in Mariupol, Anatomy of a Fall. You know, there's plenty of opportunities for people to tell like powerful stories that represents a wide swath of people. Or it can just be seen, just like in The Holdovers, people, you, a movie that looks like it was set in the 70s. If it wasn't made in the 70s, you wouldn't see all those actors in that movie.
Right. Right. Okay. Well, I'm sure we could rattle on about the Oscars past and present and future for many more hours. I'm going to talk about a film that I'm certain was nominated. I think it was nominated for Best Picture. Past Lives, the movie by Celine Song, starring Greta Lee, Tao Yu and John Magaro, amongst others. A tale of not unrequited love, but unfulfilled love set against the backdrop of Seoul in South Korea and New York City in America, just to be balanced, if you didn't know. So, yeah, I won't spoil anything, although it's not the kind of film to be spoiled, really. It's an incredibly subtle, quiet, patient story. It's my kind of romance. My favorite romance film of all time is an old British movie called Brief Encounter, which is, again, kind of about love that can't be fulfilled. I find that so much more interesting, to be honest. I feel like love and the consummation of it is something that most people experience. So these kinds of tragic stories of two people that maybe should be together but aren't together, I just think there's something more poetic and interesting about that, and I like to watch it at a safe distance rather than to experience it. So yeah, there's something much more charged to me about a kind of chaste pair of people that just keep missing. You know, you can see the sparks between the two leads in this film. Again, two people I'm not hugely familiar with as actors, which makes it all the more kind of compelling and authentic. New York City is viewed in a way that I hadn't experienced before. It doesn't feel like the typical Hollywood or even Western view of New York City. I feel like I saw parts of it that I hadn't seen before, and they were just observed in ways that I hadn't really seen them observed. There wasn't a desperate desire to make it seem like a bustling, frenetic place. It was a kind of calm, thoughtful environment. And there were no real antagonists in this movie other than just the nature of choices that you make and the timing of things. There's no melodrama in this film. It's very subtle, but it's still pulled up a lot of emotions. And yeah, it's just a wonderfully patient, calm, kind film that I couldn't recommend more. A real like antidote to louder, flashier, melodramatic kind of movies. It's the kind of thing you need to watch every now and again. You know, even in comparison to an amazing film like Poor Things, which we'll talk about later, but Poor Things is very bombastic. It's very colorful and loud and aggressive. And, you know, none of those things are ineffective in that movie, but this is just a completely different type of film. So yeah, it was a really nice kind of change of gear for me amongst some of the things that I've been watching recently. So yeah, if I'm not mistaken, you haven't got around to seeing it yet. You were going to, I believe.
Yeah, I really wanted to watch it. I've been tracking it just with, again, I think with the awards coming up, there was more opportunities for me to watch panels with the writer and director, as well as Greta Lee. Is that her name?
Yeah, Greta Lee, yeah.
Seeing Greta Lee again on interviews as well. Just sounds like fascinating. It's a bilingual movie. And just I think what Greta Lee had to do to make sure that her Korean was on par, being raised in America, and I guess just doing right with that, again, representation. And and it also, from what I understand, is a different role than she usually plays. Just, I think, making a movie like this, like in America, I'm sure it wasn't easy. So this is something that I really wanted to see.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think I've said my piece. I highly recommend it. I love films like this. You know, I like the kind of change of pace and change of volume. Like, it's nice when a movie is brave enough to be quiet. And, you know, it's like a person who speaks quietly and everyone just leans in a little bit closer. And it really forces you to pay attention to things that you might not notice otherwise. And, yeah.
Well, I kind of understand what the movie's about. So can you just tell me just what is it about?
Yeah, so very simply, Greta Lee and Tae Yoo are childhood friends in Seoul. I guess about 24 years ago when we meet them. They're young, they're 12-year-olds, but they've developed a sort of, I guess, slightly early affection for each other. Their parents take them on a date. It's quite cute. And then very suddenly, Greta Lee's character, who I think she goes by Nora Moon. I think that's the kind of Western name that they choose for her. Her family have to move to Canada, I think it is. Her father's, I think, a movie director or an advertising director, something like that. So they have to go. So this nascent relationship can never come to fruition. They fall out of touch. 12 years pass and they reconnect. He is still in Seoul. She's now in New York. She's a playwright. They become friends again. They communicate through Skype, and I guess, yeah, this, I you know, without going too much further, the story kind of goes on from there. But they're you know, the title is very apt. It's all about like how your past, I think, can almost seem like a different version of you and something that went that way. I mean, it's almost like a subtle and more realistic rumination on an idea like sliding doors, you know, like what could have been if you'd have taken the left turn instead of the right turn. And I mean, thinking about it now, it didn't strike me at the time, but there's a very obvious visual early on in the film when they're walking home together as children and he lives right up one fork and she lives left up the other fork. It didn't strike me at the time because I think this film's too subtle for that. But thinking about it now, there's definitely a sort of idea of forks in the road and what decisions you make. And obviously as children, if your parents decide to emigrate, you don't really have any say in that. So, but that connection's obviously never died for these two people and they just can't quite let go of it, even though life has taken them on completely different paths. You know, she lives in America. She speaks English. She actually, as a character, doesn't really remember Korean as well as she should. He still lives in Korea. He only speaks Korean. So, and that is used very effectively throughout the film as well, because, well, again, I won't go into it, but yeah, the use of language and how that can separate people is very interesting too. But yeah, that's the basic plot, you know, a sort of an unfulfilled romance. And I think because they're children, when they sort of fall for each other, it just makes the whole thing more kind of innocent, and there's no sexual history between these people or anything like that. It's all just about connection, which I think makes it much more powerful. And that's all I got to say about that. But I highly recommend that you watch it.
Yeah, I don't recognize Greta Lee from anything. And Cillian Song?
I think yeah, Celine. Again,
Celine Song.
Celine Song, again, yeah.
Celine Song, I also haven't seen her work as far as I'm aware. But I really look forward to seeing more from them. But I'll get started with Past Lives.
Yeah, absolutely. Get on it. Get on it. What have you got to talk about next?
Oh, the Masters of Air.
Ooh.
So, Masters of Air.
This is a documentary about, like, tuba players or something?
Well, that's coming. That's coming. You know, our podcast, next time, you know, you'll hear us, it'll be Masters of Hot Air. So, Masters of Air follows the Bloody 100th. Basically, the 100th bomber group during World War II, who just suffered massive casualties. They didn't have the highest casualty count during the air war on the American side. However, just the concentrations of deaths, like early on, just gave them this reputation to the point where other enlisted would groan or dread being part of this air group. So this is the third in, I guess, now a trilogy brought to us by Gary Goetzman, Tom Hanks, and Steven Spielberg. First you had Band of Brothers, then The Pacific, and now Masters of Air. And again, primarily historically accurate. It was based on the book Masters of Air by Donald L. Miller, which is a 700-page tome. And they just took the one element out of this book, because the book covered, I think, the whole air war. And they just decided to, like, focus on the Bloody 100th. In saying that, the show is a bit disjointed, but it makes so much sense. I enjoyed watching it. I enjoy the, again, watching history play out through this drama. My boys would come in and out, and they watched 1917 with me, which they enjoyed. And sometimes I'll try to find movies or documentaries that feature history. But so much of what we watch today is just the newest things that's dropping on the streamer or in the movies. So they don't have a real sense of history. So It's kind of funny when we're watching this and then, you know, like my sons will say, oh, that's predictable. I knew that was coming. Or one of my sons would say, oh, the predictability counter number 5, you know, just racking them up. Oh, this is predictable. This is predictable. And then at one point I'm saying, well, you know, for this is history. So this isn't something that someone made up. This isn't something that, you know, the tropes or the beats you can, you know, see in your sleep. This is something that actually happened. And I think that kind of made them perk up and draw more interest in the show. Because this is, you know, it has it all in terms of the beautiful yet horrific air war was directed by Kerry, Joji, Fukunaga, Dee Reese, Anna Boden, Ryan Flick, and Tim Van Patten. Some of the best television and movie directors that, you know, that we've seen over the past 20 to 30 years or so, you know, like Tim Van Patten, you know, was on The Sopranos and Boardwalk Empire, Game of Thrones, you know, directed, you know, these like amazing episodes or, you know, and then Kerry Joji Fukunaga, who directed the first season of True Detective. Yeah. So, I mean, it's beautiful. The technology is at a place where they can make, you know, a show like this, as well as I've been to the Air and Space Museum in Arizona and had the opportunity to see so many planes and go inside these flying fortresses. So watching this on the screen really, really moved me. Just, it makes me want to go back to the museum again, but also just knowing that I had an opportunity to be inside these planes and to be around, you know, walk on this walk across the desert to go, you know, just to go around them, and just the scale and how big these things were. And it made so much sense watching this show, how they got ripped apart by the Nazis. A lot of it was like many errors were made to the discipline, also just poor planning, and as well as that the Americans chose to fly during the day because they had a special scope for bombers, and they also didn't intentionally bomb civilian areas. On the other hand, where the Germans, I think even before World War II, didn't mind like killing civilians during air raids, and neither did the British. So during these air flights, there was tons of flak and shrapnel in the air, and just took all these guys out, as well as because they're so, you know, they're flying fortresses, you know, you have the Luftwaffe to like just fly through and just like tear them apart. So, I mean, it was horrific. And then because it's this day and age that it's filmed, I would believe more so than the Pacific and Band of Brothers is the language and the sex and just some of the gore. I mean, you've seen that in Save a Private Ryan, but like some of it's pretty bad. And then it's not a spoiler, but there's one character. So basically, going back to my point about it being disjointed, it's just because there's so many people who get killed throughout the series. And then you're also kind of, you're following primarily two airmen, and that's Austin Butler's Gale Buck Cleven and Callum Turner's Major John Bucky Egan. So these two airmen were friends going into the 100th, and they had a strong bond, and then they were considered like some of the best airmen that were part of the 100th. But as time went on, you know, and with the casualties, and there's basically, I guess, 77% chance of your plane being shot down, you had a number of other recruits coming in, like just kind of filling those slots, just coming through. So you see that throughout the show, and then some of these airmen become POWs, or kind of manage to find their way to be part of some resistances in Europe. So it's a bit scattershot. And eventually you'll see the Tuskegee Airmen come into play. Right. So I think it's more like chapters to a book opposed to something you saw in Band of Brothers, where you saw the group come from basic training and then, you know, go through Europe together. Basically, you'll see the characters throughout the war in different stages. Just not all of them will make it. And there's one major character whose death was considered a heroic sacrifice. But in reality, the way this airman died was horrific, where their bomber was shot and their air tanks caught on fire, and basically just creating like almost a blowtorch or flamethrower type effect inside the plane. Jeez. So that airman was just most likely incinerated. However, a number of airmen managed to parachute out. However, one was stuck on the tail, and as the burning fortress was like falling out of the sky, where like Nazis who were flying reported what had happened. And then in the back, the tail gunner, in the back usually there's the tail gunner and the navigator. Navigator bailed, leaving the tail gunner. And as the fire was coming through, the gunner literally heard his face crackling. So Jesus. He had no choice but to run through the fire to parachute out. And he was caught by the Nazis, and they said that his eyelids were sealed shut. Like, so some of the guys, you see them being pulled out of the fortress, just it's like just banged up or burnt. Like it's pretty, or, you know, bloodied. You'll see some of that in the series, but I think they decided not to show one of their major characters die in such a horrific manner. Hmm. But for the most part, it is factually accurate. So you have Buck and Bucky that you're following, and then also a new recruit, Robert Rosie Rosenthal, played by Nate Mann. So I would say they are pretty much the main characters. Jude Law's son, Ref Law, is one of the ground men. He's not so much of a major player. You also have Nkuti Gatwa as a second lieutenant, Robert Daniels. He's part of the Tuskegee Airmen, and he doesn't have a major part, but he's also the new Doctor Who. So this thing was filmed 3 years ago during the heart of COVID in the UK, where it was really strict. Sounds like Barry Keoghan, who plays Lieutenant Curtis Biddick, I guess, caused a little bit of trouble with that, with the NHS, where they have to come in and, you know, shut things down or, you know, call people out. But they spent $60 million on COVID procedures to make this show.
Jesus wept.
So this is one of the most expensive shows ever made. It cost between $250 to $300 million to make. Steven Spielberg said this is the biggest production he's ever worked on. I believe there's about, how many people? 3,000 crew. They built the barracks. I believe maybe possibly 81 buildings were built to make this. And let alone you had the flying, like the fortresses that they had to make. And then they used the volume to make this show. So then the fortresses were 50 feet in the air in the middle of the volume. So they could see all the planes coming around. They actually literally had to fly them. And since it was tough to get the actors in and out of these cockpits, they were up there for 7 hours a day flying. And they learned how to fly these bombers. They also brought Dale Dye, who's a very famous former military man, right? So he was the advisor on Platoon, Band of Brothers, The Pacific, Saving Private Ryan, and also apparently that something to do with like Tropic Thunder, that was maybe one of the characters, or the whole notion of Tropic Thunder was based on him.
Yeah. I mean, he's in a lot of these movies as well.
Yes.
He's definitely got a prominent role in Platoon. I'm sure he turns up as a general in Saving Private Ryan. He's like a real, he's like living G.I. Joe.
So yeah, he set them straight. All the guys got together to like, you know, for a boot camp, except for Barry Keoghan. Austin Butler was, you know, making Elvis. With Tom Hanks. Tom Hanks just tapped him, just said, look, you know, you don't know what you're going to do next. You spent 3 years making Elvis and getting into that mindset, and I know your dedication. How about come on board to, you know, Masters of Air? So you only had Austin Butler only had 1 week of rest and then jumped onto Masters of Air. And then because of COVID, all the guys were confined together and playing games and trying to keep themselves like sane and occupied. Lots of competition was going on between the actors, especially, I guess, the biggest thing was like the way you flip into a bomber. Like, you know, they would do kind of lay on the ground, jump up and flip into the bomber. And Austin Butler was had the best time for doing that. Number of other people would box with Keoghan. And they would play like different card and dice games. But it was an eight month shoot. And then it took about 10 years to make. So initially it was going to be with HBO. The writer of this show is John Orloff. His first paid work was writing the D-Day episode of Band of Brothers. And then he wrote the concentration camp episode. He wrote some, he wrote a movie that didn't get made until like 2011, but basically it was set in, it was an Elizabethan drama that he wrote. And Spielberg had a chance to see it, and Hanks, and based on this script, they just gave him the job to write a couple episodes of Band of Brothers. And eventually that movie was made and was called Anonymous. So for Masters of Air, Spielberg read it and said he wants this to be made. And it took a year for Orloff to write the Bible. And that was 250 pages. And then it took him quite a few years to write the first seven episodes. And between that time, HBO, I guess, didn't have the money, wasn't going to, you know, finance everything that was required to make it. So then Hanks and Spielberg took it to Apple, who was willing to pay all the money to put it on their streamer. And this was in 2018. They made this announcement where they took it away from HBO. But it's, I think it's a show that you can see all the money on the screen. I think it's well acted. Again, if you're looking for something like Band of Brothers, it's not quite it. Just because it's, again, a bit scattershot with the characters. But I still thought it was powerful in many moments, and I think relatable, and I think it really conveyed the horrors of war as these things do, but also the sacrifices these men made, especially the ones who, no matter how many times they were shot down, would get back up and go right back into those planes and do it over and over again. I think it's a great tribute. I mean, again, you know, some of these airmen that are still alive today, well into their hundreds, who watched some of this, you know, have their critiques in terms of like, you know, we didn't, you know, have, you know, bars this close, they were 10 miles away, we didn't have an opportunity to do that or things like that. But I think it does recognize their sacrifice. And this show is also a showcase of so many up and coming young actors as well, just like Band of Brothers. Austin Butler is probably the biggest one. You also have Anthony Boyle, who plays Lieutenant Harry Crosby. And Crosby survived the war and wrote a book called, A Wing and a Prayer. And his memoir was also, was a big part of this show. So I think his through line is very important. So he's another character that you can follow throughout this whole series. And I think he's more or less like the narrator of this show. And I think his journey is very interesting as well. But yeah, it's, I think it's well worth a watch. It's not a perfect show. At times I just kind of think it's, you know, serviceable. It's entertaining. But I think just with the history and everything they show, even with its flaws, it's worth watching.
I still need to watch Band of Brothers first, but every like big vacation that I have where I'm not taking a trip, I'm always like, oh, I really need to watch Band of Brothers, but I never quite get around to it. So maybe I've got a week coming up soon. Maybe I'll try and blast through the whole of Band of Brothers. But yeah, well, that, I mean, it sounds appealing. It's an interesting era, of course.
Yeah, I'm being like vague, but just there's, yeah, I think just so much to spoil. I mean, I'm sure you can read a history book or see some YouTube videos about the history of the 100th. Yeah. But I think just going in cold is probably the best. And also, this is probably the last one. I mean, if it took 10 years for this to make and it's so long to write and, you know, just bring all, you know, all this together, I don't think they have it in them anymore. So from what I understand, yeah, they're not going to make any more of these. Who knows? But that's according to the producer, Gary Kurtzman. He just said that it just takes too long. 5 years to write seven episodes alone. And I think all the research and the digging and to bring that authenticity to play, it's a lot. And it's also a lot of money.
For sure, for sure. No, well, very thorough. Thanks. Thank you for that. Okay, a total change of pace. Jumping in the DeLorean for a moment, rolling back the clock about 25 years to the times of Band of Brothers, I suppose. I watched Signs with the family the other day. First time I'd watched it since I saw it in the theater. Just a quick recap. If you aren't familiar, Signs is a movie starring Mel Gibson. He is a former reverend and a widower who lives with his children and his younger brother, much younger brother, played by Joaquin Phoenix. Immediately, this film does not muck around in terms of, like, you know, stating its premise. They find a crop circle in their acres of beautiful cornfields, and the rest of the film is a kind of, I would actually say, kind of a slow-burning UFO alien invasion movie. And I actually was not expecting too much. It's a movie that I think, like I say, I watched it at the cinema and I did enjoy it. I think I probably bought it on DVD, but I don't think I ever bothered to watch it again. I've referenced people leaving glasses of water around the house for years, every time anyone doesn't put their glasses away. So, you know, I mean, it made that much of a kind of dent in the pop culture brain. But yeah, I just never went back to it. And I actually, maybe it's generous on the film itself, but I love the feeling of jumping back into a movie I haven't seen for that many years and just getting this instant hit of not so much nostalgia for the movie, but just this kind of implacable nostalgia for the time. And, you know, we of course talk about nostalgia a lot, and I won't keep going on about it, but I think 80s nostalgia, as much as I love it, has kind of been mined to death. When we were kids, they were mining 70s and 60s nostalgia to death. The 90s and the early 2000s are maybe slightly less filled with obvious kind of maybe like fashion tropes and musical tropes, because it was already at a point when we were recycling a lot of culture from previous generations. So I find this kind of film interesting because anything after the year 2000 to me kind of feels fairly recent, and I have to kind of slap myself sometimes and you know, remember that we've been in this century for nearly a quarter of it now, and stuff from like 2001, 2002 doesn't seem like it's that long ago, but it's ages ago. It's 20 years ago. The world was a completely different place. You know, no one in this movie has a smartphone. They don't use the internet once to figure out what's going on. You know, they're still listening to like a wireless radio to figure out what's going on. And yeah, I just found all that kind of ephemera, and the fact that it was set in, you know, a kind of rural area, really played into its favor in a way that, making the movie at the time, they couldn't possibly have known that people watching this movie in 20 years would appreciate that, or just maybe this one guy watching it in 20 years would appreciate that. But it really kind of added something. And yeah, I just enjoyed the vibe of this movie for the 2 hours that it was on. It's a pretty ridiculous concept when you break it down, but the simplicity of a kind of alien invasion being viewed from the perspective of a family out in the middle of nowhere with very little evidence of what's going on the screen, it's quite nice. Again, it's a bit, I won't compare it to Past Lives, but it's refreshingly subtle in that respect. And there's lots of long takes, kind of subtle build up. It's got a kind of Night of the Living Dead feel to it, you know, people stuck in a house. I really enjoyed Mel Gibson in it, which, you know, I know he's probably been cancelled for many a year now, but this is one of his most restrained kind of performances. And, you know, Abigail Breslin, I think maybe in her first role, is really good. Rory Culkin is really good. Joaquin Phoenix is solid. It's, you know, M. Night Shyamalan does a cameo and he's not very good, but, you know, I can forgive him that. Yeah, I really enjoyed it. I really got into this movie. It was a great one to go back and watch with the children, and the children loved it, and they were like jumping all over the place when the aliens kind of eventually pop their hands through a door, or, you know, like you see a shadow of them here and there. I mean, you never really see very much of them, but yeah, it was really enjoyable, actually.
Yeah, that's one I really want to go back to. I have fond memories of watching the theater. I don't remember Mel Gibson at all. It's really Joaquin Phoenix is the only character that I remember from the movie. I guess I haven't seen it since the theater. but just the one scene when you see the alien on TV, there's a children's birthday party, like Aaron
in
on
Mexico
TV
or something.
Yeah. And they're like, oh, we have footage of, you know, aliens, and you see the kids at the party, and then you see the alien walk past the window and he frees it. And it was just such a great scene. But I agree, like, it's the subtlety. Also, though, like, at the time, it's like, I loved the old War of the Worlds movies, or I should say movie. And then there was also like a sequel TV series, based on the old movie from the 50s or 60s. And that's actually something I want to go back to as well. I watched the newest Spielberg movie with the kids not too long ago, and I wanted to go back and watch the one that I grew up with. But just, you know, the concept of water just reminds me the same with bacteria. There's just something natural on the planet that will protect people. And I think I liked it, but also didn't, because it was just like, yeah, just another nod to the original War of the Worlds. But it's a great movie. I mean, as far as I recall. So it's something I want to go back and watch again with the family.
Yeah, the water thing is a bit... It didn't bother me the first time I watched it. I think this time my eldest son kind of said, if they're like, if they get burned by water, why are they landing on planet Earth? And I'm like, yeah, like, it would be pretty obvious from space that there's a lot of water on that planet. And they spend a lot of time kind of sniffing around. So it's one of those kind of plot points that, you know, provided you don't pull at it, it's quite a satisfying little twist, you know, the eventual kind of solution. But again, it's not really the point, you know. It's all about faith and science and aliens, and, you know, like, the main character has lost his faith, you know, because of the way he lost his wife. He's you know, like, he's turned his back on God, and it's all very heightened. I mean, it's very, like, on the nose, but yeah, it harkened back to older films. It had a feeling of it that reminded me of early Spielberg, which I really appreciated. And it was just really interesting to step back into this time and sort of think, like, oh, that's what 2002 was like. I'd kind of completely forgotten. Things have accelerated so quickly that I just didn't even notice. And that was just quite a pleasant experience. You know, I think I felt quite cynical even at that age and thinking that, like, technology had moved on too far. But looking back now, it's like, wow, it's gone even crazier, you know, just people still listening to the radio to get information for news. Like, that seems insane to me, but there's something more cinematic about it in a way as well. Like, it's never quite as satisfying when someone just flips open a laptop or even just gets their phone out to find out the answer to a solution. It's not very dramatic. So it's a shame, you know, there's not much you can do about it, but other than set stories away from Wi-Fi and mobile phone reception. But yeah, I don't know. It's a shame.
But you know, we're in a time with a click of a button or a virus or someone knocks down some towers, it's lights out. We're in an even more precarious situation. If something goes down, everyone's going to be scrambling in the dark. And I think,
well, yeah, least, yeah,
you know, you have, like, radio and TV, and, you know, back then you'll have some different modes of information gathering, but everything's on, like, these devices, man. And something happens big, that's all she wrote. No one's going to have a TV. You're not going to have much of anything. It's all going to be gone. Yeah. We'll all be talking by the burning trash cans by the road, you know, making up stories about what had happened.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, all right. Anyway,
we're in Japan, so there are no trash cans by the road. So you won't even have that.
That's true. But then we've got, like, the tannoys all over the place that will tell us what's going on. I mean, I won't be able to understand them, but
that's true.
there'll be some updates coming through. All right. Anyway, Signs. Yeah, yeah. If you, I would, I think you'll enjoy it. And again, definitely, I know your boys are getting older, but like definitely one that you could comfortably watch with the children. I think I'm sure they'll say that it's very predictable about 600 times. But
yeah, that's right.
They'll still enjoy it. So yeah. Yeah. Well, what have you got
the
next?
Predictability meter. I was going to say the predictability meter is off the charts. next I have Poor Things.
Okay.
There is so much to this movie. It's insane in terms of symbolism and on so many levels. It's basically more or less like an inverted Frankenstein story where Willem Dafoe's Dr. Godwin Baxter, who himself was experimented on and modified and looks like horrifyingly mangled, decides to make Bella Baxter, who is played by Emma Stone. And Bella is a woman that Baxter created with a developing mind. So we follow her journey in this steampunk, I would rather call it Victorian punk movie set in Victorian England. And you follow Bella's journey, not just in England, but also she has an opportunity to go ride a ship, go to Paris, Alexandria, and you're watching this woman grow up in this world surrounded by men, and until she gets an opportunity to meet other women and just come into her own. So basically you're watching a movie of a woman child navigate the world and dealing with her different interactions with men and some women, but primarily men. And you see how she navigates womanhood and different philosophies as she experiences humanity in all its different forms. But as a movie and its themes, Bella also kind of represents not just what women have to deal with and their struggles and how what women have to do to, I guess, come into prominence and in daily life and on so many levels. But also we're watching the many stages of humanity in terms of, you know, aspects of the Industrial Revolution and the Enlightenment, Marxism, capitalism through Bella's eyes, this journey, depending on who she meets in the different scenarios. You have to pay attention to so much of beautifully created sound stages and backgrounds, the clothes, even light fixtures, everything just informs this movie. There's just so much there that you can mine in terms of understanding not just the care that Yorgos Lanthimos like put into this movie, but his team, the freedom he gave in terms of the costuming and just the sets that were built in Europe. I mean, almost all of it was practical and real. And when you really look at those backgrounds from floor to ceiling, they also tell a story and tell you where Bella's at any given moment in the film. And the same could be said about Emma Stone's costumes. It's really just, it's beautiful and it's fascinating. And as I mentioned, like steampunk or Victorian punk, I mean, but it's beautiful and it's bright and it's loud. It's a fantastical world, but it's in many ways, it's the only way to tell the story of Bella coming into her own. And with the cast, you also have Mark Ruffalo, who's Duncan Wedderburn, who whisked Bella away from her childhood home, more or less. And just the play between Emma Stone and Mark Ruffalo. I mean, many people have talked about the sex and the nudity in the film, but I mean, it's not, how can I say, it's doesn't have that male gaze. It doesn't, it's, again, it's just another way to, it's just part of the human journey and the human experience. And that's how you see it. Just, and it's remarkable that Emma Stone and like Ruffalo put themselves in, you know, such situations where Mark Ruffalo seemed to be very hesitant about the role, where he had to be convinced to take the role because of so much nudity and compromising positions he put himself in. And Emma Stone seemed to, in many ways, find it liberating and was comfortable. They had a theater camp when they met prior to filming. It's kind of similar to The Holdovers, it seems like, where not just having like reads, but actually like games or different interactions where the actors could bring more to the table in terms of what they wanted to, and in terms of how they wanted to portray those characters. And the same freedoms were given to the crew as well in terms of the designs. But seems like Lanthimos really sticks to the script ultimately, but there's still opportunities for collaboration and improvisation in terms of like the dances that you see in the movie, bringing extras in to chime in, but it still was maintained some constraints, you know, to make sure that we could see his vision for this movie. Like, he was a fan of the book. He had the rights to the book for 12 or 13 years and no one wanted to make it until he made The Favorite. And because that got so many accolades and he worked with Emma Stone, they got along really well. And he reached out to her to now to make this movie. And since she was producer, she was heavily involved in it as well. And since Lanthimos is a Greek, she would go to Athens and then just work with some of the team there. And they were also they finished their next movie, and that might be dropping sooner than later. And then you also had Gerard Carmichael as a supporting character who opens Bella's eyes at one point. And then you also have Catherine Hunter as Swinney. And she's a character that we meet in Paris. And she is a combination of PJ Harvey and Hilda Ogden from Coronation Street.
So. That's spot on.
So
sorry, that's very good. I know exactly who you're talking about.
But yeah, and then since there's connections to Frankenstein, a lot of the movie doesn't really, you know, take from Frankenstein aside from what you see that's on the nose, but really from Mary Shelley's life in terms of. Mary Shelley, mother died. And, you know, so both Bella and Mary Shelley were at, you know, times motherless, and, as well as her family were very, you know, political and had specific philosophies. Like, Shelley's mother wanted equality for women, men and women. And that's one of the themes in the movie, as well as, Shelley's father was also had his takes, philosophical takes that you can see in the flick. And then not just like this journey that we have with different eras of man's, like, you know, philosophical evolutions, but also just the way the movie was shot, like, you know, like in the 1930s framework, something similar to Dracula. And you would see how the different lenses, the different colors or lack thereof, really inform the different stages in Bella's life as well. It's a remarkable film, and just thinking about it more and more, it's something that I want to go back and watch again soon, just to see like all the things that I missed during the first time. I mean, there's just so much there. Again, we were talking about the Oscars. If it wasn't for like the Golden Globes, I wouldn't have ventured out to even, you know, watch this movie. And then I forgot to mention Rami Youssef is also in it as Godwin Baxter's assistant, Max McCandles. And he was plucked due to the hit show that he had on Hulu and some of his stand-up. So Lagomotsu reached out to him. And this is also Rami Youssef's first movie ever. So this is something that I could not highly recommend more. They've also used special film stock to make some of the scenes. And the writer, McNamara, he was tasked to write the adaption. And some of the dialogue that you hear in the movie comes from some of the things that his young children said. So initially he thought, like, if Bella's a young child, you know, she might be kind and innocent. And then he watched his kids and heard one of his kids said, I must go and punch that baby. And then remembered some of the cruelty and that children have in them. And then kind of peppered that throughout the film. But everything was well translated and from the book. And he changed a couple things near the end of the film, based on a character that comes in during the third act. Some of that was switched around, but I think it really enhanced the movie where some of those scenes weren't in the book.
Yeah, I had some minor reservations with the third act, but like as it's a very fresh film, I won't go into them. But it is something that I want to revisit. I really enjoyed it while I was watching it. I don't know if I saw it at a time when I was massively distracted by something else in life, but I kind of, I don't want to say I forgot it after I left the theater. That's not true, but I don't know. I was very in it while I was watching it. I laughed a lot. And I think there's obviously many, many layers in this film. There's a lot that's being said. But honestly, just on the level of Emma Stone playing a character who is completely unpretentious, just honestly seeking her purpose and learning in a very sped up way the nature of desire and pleasure and pain and thinking and, you know, oppression and freedom. And just she gets through everything so quickly. It was just, you know, very fun to watch just how direct she was in, you know, coming as I do from a somewhat repressed society. Yeah, it's always refreshing to see that. And it's funny, you know, just some of the lines that she delivers. And of course, everyone I think is playing it completely straight in this movie. But some of the things that they say and do. Yeah, I mean, more than anything, I laughed watching this film. And it's there's a lot of depth to it. There's a lot going on, but it really cracked me up. Mark Ruffalo had me in fits of laughter for the whole film. I wasn't particularly impressed with his British accent, but that kind of added to it. He was just this hilarious Withnalian character, I would say. He reminded me a lot of, you know, sort of Richard E. Grant in Withnail and I, just kind of this foppish, ridiculous individual, but he really got into the role. Willem Dafoe was just like wonderfully insane, and despite clearly being quite sinister and immoral, oddly likable. Yeah, it's definitely a film I want to return to and pay a bit more attention to what's going on, you know, in the whole frame, because it's a beautiful movie and very well played, and obviously there's a lot going on here, but chiefly I found it very amusing. And Emma Stone was great. She definitely deserved accolades for that performance, and she fits Yorgos Lanthimos like a glove. Like they just, they work very well together. I guess he had a bit of a kind of, he did a couple of movies with Colin Farrell, and they also were a very good match for each other. I think he just has a very interesting style with, he's very good at capturing an interesting line reading for comic effect. I think my favorite film of his is The Lobster, which is again a incredibly strange concept and a very unusual and at times very cruel film. But again, mostly I just found myself laughing at it. I think he's just got this real knack for very black comedy, which I appreciate. But yeah, I think I will return to this film and maybe cast a bit more of an academic gaze over it, because that wasn't really at the forefront of my mind when I was watching it. But again, I highly recommend it. It's, everyone in this film is on top form. As you rightly say, the whole crew working their socks off. And I mean, visually, you've never really seen anything like it in every way. You know, the cinematography, the colors, the costumes, the whole combination makes for a unique package. So definitely one to savor for years to come.
Yeah, this was a groundbreaking performance for Emma Stone, and I think it just put her into, you know, another category in terms of her career. It's a fearless role, but it also, and so is Bella. Like, it's a Bella's a character who doesn't, I guess, assign, you know, morality to things, mm-hmm. just absorbs, and then makes decisions based on whatever she thinks is rational at the time, right? Like, she could be, you know, have the mind of an infant or a child, or, you know, an adolescent, as you watch her grow and learn through her experiences. As we said, it's something we want to watch again. But also, I've never seen any of the other movies by, like, Lanthimos. So I guess, you know, he has a small library, yeah. but it sounds like everything is worth watching.
I think so.
For different reasons.
Yeah, right back to Dogtooth. I was kind of lucky enough to catch a recommendation of that when it came out, and it was a really good movie. The Lobster was great. Killing of a Sacred Deer is very good. The Favourite is very good. I think there's another one that I missed, but yeah, he's remarkably consistent. I guess I would say if you're going to watch one, personally, I would recommend The Lobster. But
well, that's the one I didn't know he directed, but I did want to watch it. The Lobster was always on my list. Mm. I mean, just, but it's, again, there's too many things and I never got around to it. But I should go back and watch the rest of the movies in his library. But The Sacred Deer seems to be sinister from what I gather.
Yeah, it's, if memory serves, that one is his most realist kind of film, I would say. It's the one that doesn't maybe have so many unusual lines of dialogue and bizarre kind of events. You know, it's still quite a twisted plot, but it feels a bit more like it's taking place in the real world, and it does have a sinister plot. And I think, if not his first role, then almost certainly Barry Keoghan's breakthrough role to bring things nicely back to, you know, people that we've been talking about recently. He's great in it. I guess he was probably in Dunkirk maybe the year before or shortly before. But it's good. It's actually probably, out of the films I've just mentioned, it's probably my least favorite of his, but it's still a very good movie and definitely worth a watch. And I've been meaning to return to it because it kind of left something unfinished in my mind. So, you know, that's maybe one for the future. Okay, let's stick with Emma Stone. And last time we talked about the first half of The Curse. I still couldn't quite binge it, but I managed 3 episodes in a night. So, and I managed to finish it off. So I'll try not to rehash over the things I already said. Needless to say, it's a wildly varied TV show. So, you know, what went on in the first half doesn't prepare you for what's going to happen in the second half. where it's going to go, the levels that we're going to see from Nathan Fielder and Emma Stone, and even some of the supporting characters, you know, make some surprising choices. I feel like no one comes out of this clean, to be honest.
Yeah, that's accurate.
The eventual ending really kicked things into another headspace. I guess languid, dreamlike would be the place that it ends up.
Really? I would say nightmarish.
Well, yeah, I mean, I'm not, I don't mean positive, just the world of dreams. Yeah. I couldn't possibly discuss or describe it though, because I just feel like you've got to watch The Curse. I don't even want to put too much pressure on, you know, oh, wait till the last episode. But like, suffice to say, the last episode, everything about it, from the TV opening with Big Pussy from Sopranos and
Rachel Ray. Yeah, that's great. It was so crazy.
She's a real person, right? Like, I don't.
Yeah, know no, Rachel that was Ray her is, show. But, like, yeah, no. So yeah, yeah, she's a. I guess she's a cook and cookbooks, and then she has the show. But I don't know what else she does, but I know her as she's a celebrity chef.
No offense to Rachel Ray, but she was too bad to be fake, if that makes sense. I'm like, that you couldn't cast someone to play this role. Like, she was so daytime TV. It was unbelievable. Mm. And it was, you know, even just that 10 minutes or so was more cringe inducing than most things you see on television. And just the left field, having a guy from The Sopranos with a, like, what was it? Like the Kingpin's cookbook or the Mafia cookbook or something. Like, it was just, and then he starts singing, like, I mean, and that's the tip of the iceberg. Like, I mean, that is one of the weirdest hours of television I think I've ever seen in my life. And it definitely left an imprint on me. It was harrowing and hilarious and horrifying. And God, it was something. But I just get the sense that not in a negative way, in a positive way, actually, I feel like Nathan Fielder is always playing a game with me, but I kind of just like letting him do it. You know, it's like, okay, where are you taking me? Like, the rehearsal was such an amazing concept. And actually, I don't think he really followed through with the concept of that show at all. But where he took it, I just didn't see coming. And that was just, what the hell is going on? Like, I mean, that was so bizarre. And, you know, the little touches, like the in the rehearsal where he has the laptop holder just it's like strapped onto, I don't know, he's got a real knack for these bizarre little things that he observes, and the mixture of outlandish storytelling with like very believable actors, you know, the people that he surrounds himself with, like the security guard in The Curse, or the guy that ends up being a security guard who's like quite a sinister individual.
Yeah.
Like, it really, you know, he just plants all these seeds. And I mean, like, it's not just Nathan Fielder, obviously Benny Safdie's heavily involved behind the camera as well. And other people, like, I think Carrie Kemper was one of the names that I recognized popping up a lot. And, you know, she's done a ton of stuff as well. Like, so the whole team, but they really, yeah, it was just so good at like planting little seeds that you'd kind of forget about, and then they'd crop back up later and kind of catch you off guard, and weird moments of awkwardness. Like, you know, he bumps into a guy that he used to work with at the hardware store, and the guy just ignores him, and to the degree that it's, again, it just goes on that little bit longer than it normally would in another show. So you're like really feeling uncomfortable on their behalf. Emma Stone kind of slowly chipping away at this artist and eventually basically just kind of buying her. It's really unpleasant to watch because you feel like this person's got scruples, but ultimately, like everyone else in the world, she's got a price, you know, and
right.
You know, there's a great sort of close-up, a lingering close-up where this woman's just kind of sold out, and you just see her soul die on camera. And yeah, I mean, wow. Like, what's next? What's he got up his sleeve next? I can't wait.
Well, I guess two things. One, it sounds like Emma Stone made a joke and got wrapped up into the show where I guess her and Nathan Fielder have friends in common. Mm-hmm. And then Safdie and Fielder like texted her. It's like, oh, we got a concept for a show. Do you want to join? She's like, oh, yeah, of course. And I guess it was a one-off. And then they called her immediately. And then she got wrapped into the show. But I'd say she's the best thing about it. Like, like her character's arc is amazing, and just the acting, and you know how funny and cringeworthy she is, and you know, she's a great addition. But and also, if you want to, you know, get your, you know, Fielder fixed, I don't know if you watched Nathan For You yet. Have you watched any of it yet?
No, but I've got it, and I'm going to. Yeah, it's waiting. It's kind of like. It's in the VHS player, ready to play, but obviously not the VHS player, because who's got one of those?
Maybe the aliens from Signs. I don't know.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, they stole them all, probably. That's where they went.
but yeah, that's it's really funny. No, Nathan For You is really funny, but then the last, I wouldn't necessarily call it episode, it ends with a documentary, and I guess that's the closest thing to the rehearsal. Maybe it's like proto rehearsal, but it follows one of the, you know, myriad of crazy people that he gets off of Craigslist to, you know, involved in these, like, I don't know, call them pranks or scenarios. I don't even know what to call it, but he reaches back to one of these guys and then like this, and they embark on this journey together. Some people say it's mean, like, like some of it's mean-spirited, but I mean, it's undoubtedly, I mean, it's funny. It's like, it's not as crazy. Like, you know, this stuff you're talking about, the curse and the rehearsal, is like all next level stuff. And the first episode of Nathan For You is, you know, like typical low budget, like Comedy Central stuff. You watch the first one, you're like, okay, whatever. And then just, you know, as just the longer goes on and like the crazier it gets, like these scenarios that he concocts, yeah, but it's worth watching, and it's hilarious.
Yeah, I definitely it's a will watch. It's not even a, there's no doubt about that. Probably it's got a better chance of being watched than Band of Brothers at this stage. I find it refreshing when people just do something to. Yeah, just to challenge you a little bit and do something different that you know, comes out of left field. It's not every single thing lands in either of the shows of his that I've watched, and sometimes I'm really scratching my head. I mean, last time we talked briefly about the third series of Twin Peaks is another example of something that can kind of throw you just in terms of how far someone will go. But there's definitely parallels, I think, between Nathan Fielder and David Lynch. You know, like they're also totally different, but just that ability to go with an idea and follow it through all the way, whether it's working or not, I kind of respect that, because it's just refreshing. You know, I mean, here's something to watch with your children. They're not going to call the predictability meter on this one. And if they can see what's coming in the curse, then, you know, fair play. Because it really took me by surprise. So many random, like, what on earth happens that the episode where Betty Safdie just like wakes up in the middle of the desert, like that doesn't go anywhere. Like, what's that all about?
Yeah, but there's, it's also so yeah, but there's,
I mean, it's
also
great, but
yeah, there's also some of the characters that kind of, you know, when you meet up with them again and it's really bizarre, and you just it's almost like, you know, in reality, like people kind of come and go in your life,
yeah,
but like just, but the way, like they'll create this this scene and with these characters, and it's just left off in this, like, again, bizarre, awkward way, and you as the audience, you have no idea what's going on. Right. What has happened, and there's no follow through, but then reality there isn't. Yeah. Like, no, you might, you know, you run into people and, you know, or you meet up with them a couple of times and something weird happens and you never hear from them again. But like, yeah, it just leaves you like some of these things like lingering, like it's pretty weird.
Well, and yeah, like it mines so much reality in its kind of far-fetchedness and, you know, surreality, like surrealness, I guess would be the accurate word. Like I'm thinking, again, I won't spoil it, but towards the end, someone receives an incredibly generous gift.
Right. And just that's what I'm talking about.
Barely reacts. And it's
right.
But how many times right. have you thought, I'm going to do this wonderful thing for someone, and they're just kind of like completely indifferent. And you're like, oh, and you can't help but feel sympathy and the way that they play it down. And because they're so in these roles, like particularly Emma Stone as being like this benevolent person, you're like, I just wanted to see her kind of lose her temper, but she wouldn't admit that what had happened was really ungrateful, and they actually genuinely did something really nice, and the person they do it for is just kind of meh.
Also, the situation that they were in, like, or yeah. the gift receiver was like people around and like people we'd never seen before. It was all so weird and cagey, and yeah, it's just some weird stuff going on, and it's just like. Yeah, and then it's just over. You have no idea what's going on, right?
I remember I once in my formative years, I was, you know, never a very good pickup artist. I'll freely admit it, but I wrote a short screenplay and dedicated it to this girl that I was fond of, and rather than just telling her, you know, like this was my ploy. And I knew where she lived. This already sounds sinister. So like I waited. I kind of loitered, I suppose, would be the legal term, outside her house, because I knew she was working and I knew she'd be coming back at some point. And she came back and I handed her this, you know, neatly stapled document and kind of said like, ah, I wrote this for you. And in my head, she was going to read, you know, that it had her name on it, and she was going to, like, I don't know, invite me in or something. And she just gave me the most horrible look, because she just finished like an 8-hour shift and she was in like waitress clothes and probably felt like horrible. And she just kind of took it, and I she might have said thanks and then just kind of walked into her house and like didn't even say goodbye. And I was like, what the hell just happened? And it crushed me. But like in my head, this was going to go a completely different way. Like I put a lot of time into it. I mean, it was absolute tripe, but you know, like I'd put like a month into it, and I was like, this is the way, you know, this is the big sweeping romantic gesture, and it didn't achieve anything. So I don't even know if she read it. I think she might have just thrown it away. I don't think I ever spoke to her again. So yeah, I can see that kind of thing in reality a lot. So
well, the curse really mines that energy, and like Fielder's character is a lot of that. Well, I guess Emma Stone's as well, right? Like, I think, you can see that. And some of it's,
totally.
Unforced errors on their part. But yeah, that's really funny.
It is.
I'm sorry to hear about your story, because I've experienced many things like it. And just like my stomach's turning and cramping up as you tell it. And I'm like, oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I can relate. You know, it's my poor things moment. Just growing up and navigating the world.
Exactly. When you don't know how to do it, when you don't know that the simplest route is probably the best most of the time, just be clear, be direct and honest, and at least you'll know. But we have to go through these travails to learn.
Yeah, you know, you'll eventually get it, you know, by 60. And you're like, oh, that's what I should have done, and impart that information possibly to your grandchild if you actually ever win a girl over, if you know. By that time, you have that knowledge.
And I'll still have 20 years to have a kid if Pacino and De Niro are anything to go by. So.
Oh, come on, man. You got until 90 looking at those dudes. At least.
Okay. Well, there you go. 6 more things to check out: the Oscars, Past Lives, Signs, Masters of the Air, Poor Things, and The Curse. So thank you dearly for listening, listener. We've enjoyed doing our research for you. And as ever, you can find me on TikTok dropping short movie reviews. That's Dr. Welp. Also on Instagram. Also newly anointed to Threads, although I haven't posted anything yet because I'm so intimidated by the huge wealth of talent there. I feel like my first post needs to be something fantastic. What about you, B? Where can we find you?
I'm hardly on X, but on X as Who Is BC Noir, and then on Blue Sky, which I hardly use, Instagram, and then Threads as BC Noir. I'm also on TikTok and just intimidated by the sheer volume of movie reviews and trivia questions that Dr. Welp rolls out on a weekly basis that I just feel it's better off just to leave a blank TikTok screen when you click on my icon.
Well, you've got more followers than me with no content, so yeah. I don't really understand how the world works, but who knows, you know. less is more.
Oh, that'll change, my friend. That'll change.
I'm sure.
You know, look. Those two listeners, they'll follow you on TikTok.
I know. Yeah, so thank you if you made it to the end. Next time, we are going to be talking about Rowdy Harrington's magnum opus, which is, of course, Patrick Swayze in the original Roadhouse. Obviously, Jake Gyllenhaal has just, with Doug Liman, remade Roadhouse 35 years later. I don't think I would have predicted that in a million years. So we thought it would be time to jump into our nearest Buick Riviera and head to the Roadhouse. So please tune in if you want to have a taste of retro Roadhouse raucousness. But otherwise, thank you so much for listening. I've been Dr. Welp.
BC Noir. We'll see you on the flip side.